Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Jim O'Neill, who, with his wife, Carolyn Burns, whose interview you will hear next week, created the Rubicon Theater, the very first professional theater in Ventura, California. Jim's story is very interesting to me because it wasn't until he was almost an adult that he figured out that what he needed to be was an actor, a person who is committed to telling our stories. This show is different from anyone I've ever done before because, as I will explain at the beginning, I didn't record most of Jim's interview. I screwed up the technology. And as a result, I am telling his story. Oh, how I hope I did a good enough job, a job that is worthy of Jim O'Neill. And if you're curious, hang on, because here comes the show. Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being all that you are. All that you are. Not just what you came out of childhood believing it was okay for you to be, but all that you really are. If you've been listening, you've heard me say, virtually every week, that as a therapist, I am aware that many of us, dare I say most of us, are demonstrating a version of ourself which, while true, is not the whole truth. That so many of us were discouraged in our early life, either by our family of origin, or our culture, or our siblings, or our peers, or very often our school, or even our religion, to decide that certain things about us were not attractive, or not okay, or even were evil. In any case, we were convinced that demonstrating these aspects of ourselves was going to bring us a consequence that we really didn't want, and in some cases might even not have survived. So there's a large range here. You know, you teased your sister because you thought it was funny, and one of your parents punished you, and you decided that being funny in that way was dangerous, and so you became a very serious person, and were not comfortable with any kind of teasing or any kind of silliness or frivolity. And you know, generally speaking, that's not such a terrible thing, except that in that case, as in every case where we have had to deny something about ourselves, you suspect that there's a frivolous person inside of you. And that, you know, the Woody Allen line, you know, that's not the Woody Allen line. His line is, you know, I wouldn't want to be in a club that wanted me. I don't know whose line it is that if you really knew me, you wouldn't like me. But that's how we feel, that there's something inside of me. I'm not demonstrating it, and I'm denying it, but I suspect it. And that feeling that there's something basically flawed about me actually alters our ability to live the life we are capable of living, to enjoy the life we are capable of enjoying, of being at ease, at peace, of loving ourselves, of believing that we deserve to be loved, even for something as seemingly insignificant as your ability to make fun of or be silly or be frivolous. So it is in many ways the basis of my work to be helping people figure out what they might have had to deny and see if they can rediscover it. And that's my work as a therapist. My work in the radio show is to make this point that there may be something about you. It may be something as seemingly, as I said, insignificant as, you know, whether you can make jokes or not, but it may be something much more important, like whether you can stand up for yourself in a situation where you're being treated badly or taken advantage of. Or maybe it's a skill or a talent that you came into this life with but were discouraged from exploring. I have a client who came into this life with a beautiful voice, and although she was encouraged to use that in her family, they had a very limited idea of what it was all right for her to sing. And so although she has desire to sing other things, she never has been able to. There's a governor. I don't know if you know that word. They used to use it in cars to keep the car from going more than a certain speed. They put a governor on it so that the car would only go so fast. So she has a governor, and lots of us have governors, which we may or may not be aware of. In any case, that is the reason I do this show. That is what I'm trying to achieve with this show. And if you've been listening, you know that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I do that because it's so difficult to do in this culture. That if you are someone
who is given a life or made a living or tried to make a living with an art, it is because you have no choice. It is definitely who you really are, at least in that aspect of your life. And when you listen to people who talk about that, then you can hear their commitment to themselves. It's what we therapists call congruence. So that now that, in case I might forget later, I'm going to give you my website and tell you what you can find on the website. And then I'm going to tell you about this show, which is different from any other show that I have done. So the website is thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. And on the website, you can read my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can read my article called Psychotherapy on the Go, that's about what it's like to do therapy on the phone, which is the way I do it these days. You can click on Email Me and ask me any questions about the show, questions about therapy, questions about me. There's pretty much anything you might want to know about me is on the website. Also, all the shows I have ever done are there in podcast form, including this show. So why is this show different from all others? It is different because when I interviewed Jim O'Neill, who is an actor and a director and the co-founder of the very well-respected and the first professional theater in Ventura County, I didn't record it. Or at least I didn't record all of it. When I realized that I wasn't recording it, maybe 40 minutes into the interview, I did record Jim talking about the theater and their season. But what I didn't get is essentially why I do this show, and that is Jim talking about how he became who he is and what he's done in his life. And I agreed that I would tell his story. And I will soon be telling his story. But there is this caveat. First of all, I am going to tell it in sort of chronological form. That's not the way Jim told it. Because as we were talking, things came back to Jim. And he told me memories of his life. But they're out of sequence. They're out of order. So I can't remember, and it wouldn't make any sense anyway if I told them out of order. So I'm going to tell the story more or less in order. So in that way, it's vastly different than Jim telling it, but it's vastly different than Jim telling it in a much more significant way. Jim O'Neill is a thoughtful, serious, philosophical person, and you are missing what I got. And I'm so sorry about it. You're missing hearing him remembering, putting together ideas, seeing a pattern where he may or may not have seen it before, exploring what it means as he is discovering it. And you can hear in the interview, which of course you cannot hear when I do it, his absolute certainty that this is what he was meant to do, that he is doing what was given to him to do, what is essential. And he uses that word many times, that this is his essence. So you have my deepest regret and apologies for keeping this information from you. I hope I don't do it again, although I have done it before. And I simply cannot always work the technology in the way I would want to, even when it's very simple, which is what I have. In any case, here is what I recall of what Jim told me about his life. Jim O'Neill did not start out to be an actor. He didn't have any intention or leaning or yearning or idea that theater would be a life for him. He and his siblings did a lot of playing, a lot of play acting, but it didn't occur to him to think of this as a career. So how did it happen that he gave his life to this work? He recalled, as we were talking, that his mother, who had nothing to do with the theater and no particular interest in it, was called on to direct a production of a Christmas play at their church. When I asked Jim why that happened, he didn't know and regretted that he never got an opportunity to ask his mother why she did that. She never did anything like that before, and she never did anything like that after. And Jim was not intending to be in it, and apparently she was not intending to have him in it. He was simply sitting in the auditorium as she and her friend were auditioning cast for this production. The production required someone to play a father who was reading the Christmas story to his daughter, and as he read the story unfolded around them. Jim was sitting in the audience waiting for a ride home from his mother, just observing the auditions. He says that he suddenly had this thought, and it was, no, they should be doing this as though it is real. He doesn't know where that thought came from. And interestingly and ironically, he doesn't remember what happened after that. His very next memory of it is sitting on stage as the father in this production. But this did not encourage him to become an actor. He put it aside. He was playing tennis, he said. Although he assures me that tennis pro would never have been a career he could have had. Okay, so we fast forward now to, I think it was high school, but maybe it was junior high school. And he's, it must have been high school because he's a junior or a senior, and he has taken all the credits he needs. And so he's available, available to him now to take a lot of electives. And apparently in his school, there was a meeting in which all of the possible electives and the teachers who taught those electives were there, and you could wander around and choose what it was you were going to do. And Jim says he had no idea, really, what he was going to do, what he was going to fill up his elective card with. But the drama teacher came over to him, tapped him on the shoulder, and said, "Why don't you try this?" Again, he has no idea why the drama teacher chose him. He says that, of course, the drama class is always overburdened with girls, and they always need boys. But that doesn't exactly explain why this particular drama teacher chose this particular boy to invite into drama class. And I guess it is drama class. And so he did it. He did it, and he was in a bunch of plays, and still, there's no decision. The next memory that he described to me was of being in a car with his parents. They were going somewhere. And his father said, and this too is kind of interesting because although he had been in lots of plays, there doesn't seem to have been any sign that he was looking at this as some kind of career. So his father said, so are you thinking about making this a career? Or words to that effect. And Jim says that he had this extraordinary experience. His mouth said, oh no. And he parroted back, and I believe that was his word, what everybody had said to him about a career as an actor or in theater. No, no, it's not secure. You can't really make a life of it. It's very difficult. And oh, no, 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 no. And as his mouth is saying, no, 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 his essence is saying, yes. This certainty that even though his conscious mind is saying it's not a good idea, his essential self is saying, this is who you are. And he pursued that. He wound up going to conservatory, studying acting, working as an actor. I think some 14 years later, beginning work as a director. He has a long career as a director and an actor, living the life that was essentially his to live, the life his essence told him was his, and he honored it. This, of course, is the point of the Lin Show, that it is possible to know who you really are, and it is possible to honor that. And even when it's difficult, and I'm sorry you don't get to hear Jim talk about the difficulty of being an actor. Of course, you don't need Jim to tell you that. If you know an actor, you know it. And if you listen to the show, you've heard other actors talk about it. It's not an easy life. Our culture makes it very, very difficult. But it doesn't matter. If it is who you are, there's a satisfaction in being you that makes the difficulty acceptable. It's an acceptable price to pay for the pleasure of being you. So Jim tells me that after, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years of doing this, it occurred to him that it wasn't going to get easier as he got older. And that if he wanted to continue a life in theater, he could, and in fact did, create a theater. And that is how the Rubicon Theater, which he founded or co-founded with his wife, Carolyn Burns, whose interview you will hear, because I was careful when I interviewed her and I didn't lose it. So Jim and Carolyn opened the Rubicon Theater, as I said, the very first professional theater in Ventura County, California. And I was able to get this about here. I realized I wasn't recording. And I was able to get Jim on, well, it isn't tape because it's digital, talking about the theater and their season, their upcoming season. And I will play that for you. So you will get to hear Jim's voice and you will get to hear his seriousness and you will get to hear his commitment to this work, which he describes as the work of essentially helping us understand our humanity. He is committed as is Carolyn, to the idea of telling stories, stories which show us our humanity. And he will talk about the importance of listening to those stories, hearing those stories, sharing those stories in the context of the theater. So now, finally, with deep regret and apologies if I didn't get it completely right, is Jim O'Neill.
Okay, so our ethic in starting the theater was that, or one of them was that we were going to be a professional theater. First professional theater in Ventura County ever. And like I was saying, it doesn't necessarily point to the high quality. But if you aspire to it, you have a better chance because by aspiring to that, you're going to bring more resources. You have to. If you're going to pay actors, you have to go out and get more resources. Well, if you're going to go out and get more resources for that, then more resources for other things are going to come. So you have sort of, by doing that, a better chance at seeking the quality that you're after.
How do you get more resources?
Asking for donations, basically.
Really?
I mean, yeah. We're, like all theaters across the country, generally speaking, half and half.
Really?
And it doesn't really even matter that much how many seats you have. People think, come in and say, well, you don't have enough seats. That's the problem. Well, yeah, we'd get more audience. Thereby, we'd get more donors.
Right.
But this minute that goes from 200 to 400, the unions charge more, too,
yes,
for actors.
Right.
And you have a bigger space to maintain. And you have so, generally speaking, across the country, it's half and half. At most theater companies or most opera companies or most dance companies or, you get half from ticket sales or other ancillary revenue, earned income it's called, and then half from the largesse of the community.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's the larger community, the National Endowment for the Arts, or your local donors, it's generally half and half.
Were you living here? Is that why you chose this?
Yes. So we wanted that at the beginning, that we were going to be a professional theater, we're going to pay actors, we're going to hire union actors, and all of that. And knowing that we were starting a company that was the first, not the first theater company, but the first professional theater company, the first theater company that would aspire in that way. And this goes back to our own experience, too, because we both did everything.
Mm-hmm.
Musicals, comedies, dramas. Throughout our careers, we were not committed to one sort of thing or the other. We just loved it all.
Mm-hmm.
And did it all, And but also because we were going to be the only one, at least for the moment, for the time being, we felt like what we wanted to do was do it all. Which many companies do. Some specialize.
Mm-hmm.
Some choose specialty niches, And so we're the Beckett Company, the Signature Theater in New York, does just their whole season is one playwright.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of thing is specialization. But we wanted to do it all. So comedy, drama, musical, we started out saying we're going to do a season of, we didn't have any place to be. This place we were not in. But we thought it could happen, and so we chose a season that could happen in various venues, potentially, around town.
Wow.
And it was by way, sort of introducing ourselves, And we found ways to do that through the course of that year, 1998-99. And we did a comedy, a drama, a musical, and a classic piece. Since then, we've added new plays, and we've done more than one every season since.
Wow.
New productions of new plays, world premieres. But that's what we do. So to this day, that's what we do. We try to do a mix of things. We try to do something that is, if you've never been to the theater, if you're a young person, or if you're an older person who's never been to the theater, doesn't have anything any idea of what the theater is about, it's a point of entry. It's perhaps a little easier to slide into.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And then on the other end, we try to do something that's challenging.
Sophisticated,
challenging. Beckett, for example.
Mm-hmm. But not breathe.
But not breath.
And
well,
breath, right?
No, we did do breath.
You did?
Yeah, we did a whole Beckett festival in 2005, I think it was, or four. And we did every one of his plays.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. In one form or another, in one way or another. So we try to do, and then everything in between, you know, something entertaining, something challenging, something edgy, something, you know, but within the mix of what the theater has to offer, comedy, drama, musical, shows,
right.
Classics, you know, Shakespeare, Shaw, all that. So
something for everyone.
Yeah, and you'd be surprised. I mean, there's so many ways in which, so many times this happens. Somebody decides for whatever reason to subscribe, which is a very, it's taking a leap of faith, you know. But if you've hopefully been to 3 or 7 or however many, and you go, well, you know, I may not like them all, but, you know, they're always going to be a certain quality. And, you know, hey, that one surprised me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know that. I would never have chosen that. If I'm a subscriber, I'm going to go to all of them, and it's about a body of work. And guess what? There is going to be one that you don't like.
Right.
That doesn't touch you, that doesn't move you, but does someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be one that surprises you on the other end that says, I never had any idea that and if you don't do that, if you don't make that commitment, you may lose that.
Yes.
You know? Opportunity
mm-hmm.
to find out something you
didn't know about yourself.
You didn't know about yourself,
mm-hmm.
and because you wouldn't have chosen it.
Right. So in addition to, and I will recap what you were talking. Actually, maybe you could talk a little bit now about the philosophy of the theater being a place where human beings experience.
I think it goes back to the campfire, you know, and beyond probably. I don't know, you know, what even our earlier ancestors that were not even necessarily humans had some sense of community. I don't know. But I do know that, you know, it's storytelling, telling each other our stories has been, you know, an important aspect of being human. For as long as we have recorded history.
Yeah.
And so it maybe starts with cavemen around a campfire, you know, telling stories of, you know, their kids' stories about how they avoided getting killed by bears.
Painting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
For practical purposes, probably, you know, it's like, don't go near bears, you know, or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, but eventually art emerges. Those cave paintings that you mm-hmm. reference, you know, eventually it becomes something that is clearly beyond the practicality.
Yes.
You know, the need to teach your children how not to get eaten by a bear. But there's something else happening here, some other way that our souls are communicating with each other and connecting to each other. And that's what we call storytelling. And our more modern incarnation of that is manifest in the theater.
Mm-hmm.
Other things too, movies and
right.
things. But starting with the theater, we think of the modern place where we tell stories to each other. Going to a place where we sit in, not just with our peers in the audience, because if you look at a movie, the movie is, the actors aren't there.
Right.
But also the artists are there. And there's some sense of give and take and communal experience back and forth from the stage, not just across the audience.
Right.
And that's our expression, at least for the last 4,000 or 5,000 years, you know, since the Greeks, you know, since we know the recorded history of the theater, of that incarnation.
Yeah.
And it hasn't changed very much.
No.
We have electric lights. instead of doing plays out of doors, like in the afternoon, like Shakespeare did, or like the Greeks did,
right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
And we're covered over with a building, mm-hmm. Whereas they were mostly open air.
Right.
And what else is different?
Right.
An actor walks out and talks to another actor or to the audience and walks across the stage and attempts to communicate some sort of essence of life.
Yes.
As we know it. That's the same as it was 5,000 years ago.
That's amazing.
Except for the electric lights and the ceiling on the building.
Yes.
Really, it's exactly the same. So, you know, we're participating in something which is essentially not changed. To think that there's a 5,000-year history of if you invited an ancient Greek into our space,
they would recognize it.
Oh, I know
right.
where I am.
Yes.
I'm in a theater. Oh,
right.
Oh, there's
yeah.
a ceiling. Oh, where is that light coming from?
Right.
But they would know it as a theater.
Yes.
They would understand, oh, there's someone, there's a stage. There's someone on a stage. I'm here. I'm watching.
Right.
I'm participating across. They would know everything about it other than, how do those lights turn on? And why did you put a ceiling?
Right.
You know?
Right.
They'd know everything about it.
Right.
And you would be in connection with someone from 5,000 years ago. On so many levels, immediately.
The human experience that hasn't changed.
Yeah.
That is still,
yeah.
right? Just the
yeah.
human experience.
Yeah.
Right.
So I started out talking, trying to talk about the season. But anyway, so we try to do a mix of things.
Mm-hmm.
A new show, comedy, drama, musical, a classic, something that appeals to someone who may be coming for the first time or is, you know, a neophyte, someone who is sophisticated on the other end, and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
So our two dramas this year are one called The Sunset Limited by Cormac McCarthy, who wrote the movie No Time for Old Men, No Place for Old Men.
Oh, yes.
I'm getting the title wrong. Apologies to Cormac McCarthy. But anyway, this is a play called The Sunset Limited, and it's a two-hander, what we call a two-hander, two-character play. It's a very sort of life-affirming philosophical piece. A man wants to commit suicide and is rescued and is brought into the house of the person who rescues him. And discussion ensues. And then the other drama is also a classic, what we think of it as a modern classic anyway, A Moon for the Misbegotten by Eugene O'Neill. And we're doing three musicals. A Rubicon Family Christmas, which comes this Christmas time, is a repeat. We've done it, I think, now three times. And each time it's been slightly different, but it's basically a compilation of holiday songs with a staging. No dialogue. Kids from our outreach program are generally in the show as well. The concept for it was created and directed by, and it is will be directed again by Brian McDonald, who runs our education outreach mm-hmm. programs. And it's just a wonderful holiday evening of songs that you know and, you know, present.
Just feels good.
It's a feel-good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then we're doing, right after that, because that closes early, a couple weeks before Christmas, one of two new shows for the year is also a musical, and it's also a Christmas thing, which we did a reading of last year, a staged reading of, and it's still in the process of development, so it's still changing, but we're going to add some production elements to it this time around and keep developing it. It's by John Caird, who is a co-writer and co-director of Les Miserables, won the Tony Award for that, along with Trevor Nunn. And his musical writing partner, his name is Paul Gordon, who's written a lot of pop hits. And also, they collaborated on a production of a musical about based on Jane Eyre, which was in New York. And it's called Little Miss Scrooge. It's a lot of Dickens, but it's sort of a Dickens mashup. But the two principal stories are the Scrooge, the Christmas Carol story, except it's set in the present day, and this is his great granddaughter, Estella Scrooge, who is the head of a investment banking firm in New York.
Of course she is.
And she's to foreclose. She comes to foreclose on an
orphanage.
A hotel for the downtrodden.
Yeah, right.
Out in Ohio. And she is visited by the ghosts, and you can imagine everybody who knows Christmas Carol kind of knows what happens.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But it's sort of mashed up with the story of Great Expectations, because there's a love interest for her, and he's Pip Nickleby. So he runs the hotel. And so it's a mashup of those two great Dickens novels with a lot of other Dickens references thrown in, and terrific new music and all of that. So we're continuing to develop that. And then the final musical is a two-hander called Two Pianos, Four Hands. And it's piano. And it's extremely entertaining. Two people on the piano, and it's been done a lot around, and it's just a wonderful evening of music. And, and then comedy. We're doing Noises Off, which is a big show, you know, for our space. We've done a lot of big shows in our space, Man of La Mancha, Fiddler on the Roof, and others as well. Plays, too. Well, we did Hamlet. And a lot of other larger shows, but this is, you know, Noises Off is a big show.
Oh, yeah. It's a complicated show.
And a complicated show, lots of doors.
Right, lots of doors. It's all about the timing.
Yeah, all about the timing. And, of course, it's a farce, as most people know, you know, it was made into a film, but, and has been done quite a lot.
Yeah.
But it's a, you know, it's a scream.
It's a scream.
Yeah, it's a scream.
It's a scream.
It's just a really fun evening in a theater. I'm directing a play called Collected Stories by an author named Donald Margulies. It's about it's a very interesting two-hander again, two women, young woman and an older woman. They're both writers, and it's a mentor relationship, or at least that's how it begins. And then the girl, it turns out, has been gathering information to write a book, which is loosely based on the older woman's life.
I know this piece.
Life. Mm-hmm. And so it examines the student-mentor relationship. Where can you cross the line with what you've learned from someone, if it's personal? Very interesting sort of, you know, coming of age, but psychological and...
It's a whole question of ethics.
Ethical concerns.
Mm-hmm. And also what relationships, what's appropriate in a relationship, what is...
Well, where do you cross the
line? Where do you cross the line, right.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So that's very interesting. That's the show that I'm directing.
Mm-hmm.
And then our final show of the season is our world premiere.
Mm-hmm.
It's called 23 and a Half Hours. And we did a reading of it last year. We're going to do a full production of it this coming year. A high school teacher is accused of an impropriety. The only proof is what the student said. And it's about the effect of that on that person's life, his whole family's life, and it's about trust. It's about losing trust. How far can you go, even if you're a wife or a son? It's it's a very compelling sort of psychological study. Not unlike doubt.
I was thinking that.
Or
Little Foxes.
Or, yeah, many others that ask those kind of questions.
But I have a question I want to ask you, the question I would have asked you anyway if I had the rest of your interview, which I can still not believe I don't have. But it is this. Having spent a life, and you really have spent a life, in the theater in one way or another, creating theater in one way or another, is there anything you would say about what that's like? Or anything else you might want to say about it?
It's so many things. It is life because it's frustrating and it's exhilarating and it's hard and it's rewarding and it's doesn't seem rewarding enough. And, you know, it's everything I think everybody else thinks about whatever kinds of lives they lead. You know, it encompasses. It is a life.
Forgive me, but I think that what you just said is not completely accurate. I don't think that everyone, I would go even further really, I would say I think a small percentage of the world would say about the way they have chosen to spend their life that there are moments of exhilaration.
Hmm.
I think we're still having quiet desperation.
Hmm. Well, that's another, go back, there's Thoreau again, right? Most
that's
men
right.
lead lives of quiet desperation.
Yes, I know.
Well, that may be true. It's sad to think.
Yeah, it is, but I think that living, that what you describe, the variety of experience that you described.
The up and the
then
down.
The down
and the
valley.
And
right, the whole thing, you know.
It's a roller coaster.
Really, but it really can be all that in the theater or in art, right? And not necessarily true for everybody.
The other thing that I'm just reminded that it does is it exposes you to yourself.
Ah, yes.
All the good and the bad, you know. And you're forced, you know, by circumstance to take a look at those things. And sometimes you just want to run screaming and say, you know, most people don't have to think about this. Why should I? You know, I just want to live, you know, or whatever it is. But it will not let you go because that's what art does. You know, it presents us to ourselves and our deepest thoughts and our shallow thoughts and our, you know, everything that we are. And it doesn't do any different for you individually if you're in it.
Yes.
And sometimes that's a challenge. Sometimes you don't want to go there, you know. And sometimes you're exhilarated to find out that, well, you know, maybe I'm not so bad, or maybe I'm better than I thought I was,
or maybe
I'm not all the time, you know, not all the time. I'm going to make another mistake tomorrow, and, you know, I don't know.
Actually, I think that's a great place to stop. Thank you so much, Jim.
Thanks.
And of course, if you've been listening to the show, you know why, for me, that was a great place to stop. Because it is the point I keep trying to make in this show, and that is that people who make their living or their life with an art are people who are committed to being who they are. And as Jim so, I don't know, poignantly points out, it's not always, you know, sweetness and light. It's not always delight and pleasure. Discovering the things about yourself that you had to hide, or that you might not be that proud of, or that you suspect other people will judge, or that you judge. Discovering those things, it can be disturbing, but it's the path to living the life you were meant to live. And as he also says, there's such reward and fulfillment and satisfaction in it, that it's worth the price. So He didn't say, Carolyn talks a little bit about this in the interview that I'm going to do next week, but calling the theater the Rubicon, for those of you who don't know, Julius Caesar needed to cross the Rubicon to advance his career. But crossing the Rubicon meant that there was no turning back. Once he got into the Rubicon was a river, and once he began to cross it, his the die was cast. He needed to go forward. It's a leap of faith. And it is the leap of faith that Jim O'Neill and Carolyn Burns made when they tied their future to this theater, to the Rubicon. And they have benefited everyone who has anything to do with the show. I'm sorry, anything to do with the theater, the community, first and foremost. When I was going to the theater to interview them, I stopped and asked somebody on the street for directions, and she asked me where I was going, and I told her. And she said, oh, the Rubicon, yeah, my parents have season tickets, and I get to go all the time. And I thought it was sweet that an arbitrary person on the street in Ventura, California, not only knew about the theater, but was an enthusiastic supporter of the theater. And so the community has benefited. And the actors, the children that they outreach to, the people not only from the community, but the audience who comes from wherever they come, right? You can't participate in something like this without having its essence, what it intends to rub off on you. So I want to say, because Jim didn't say, that the first show of the season, which he described, The Sunset Limited, which is that two-character play about someone who is attempting suicide, and it is uplifting, so we can hope that he doesn't pull it off. And it is starring Emmy Award-winning actor Joe Spano, who, if any of you watch TV or go to the theater, you know who he is. And that first show is going to open on October 23rd and run through November 17th. And I'm going to tell you how to get in touch with the theater. You can call them at 805-667-2900, and you can pay for those tickets any way that one can pay for anything. I'm going to give you the telephone number again, because I never write it down fast enough when people are giving it to me. So it's 805-667-23. I'm sorry. I'm dyslexic. It's so sad. I'm going to do it again, and hopefully I'm getting it right. 805-667-2903. Oh, Christ, that's the fax number. Well, it is my dyslexia. I'm so embarrassed. Okay, forget everything I said. I'm going to give you the number now. It is 805-667-2900-2900. Forget everything I said up until that moment about the telephone number. Okay. Well, I hope that you are looking forward to next week's show, in which I will interview Jim's wife and co-founder of the Rubicon, Carolyn Burns, who is, beside being interesting and compelling, she's just delightful. And hers is a very different story from Jim's, but nonetheless interesting. So, by all means, please tune in next week. And as always, boy, I hope you got something from this show that you can use. Something that you knew or had forgotten. Something that you didn't know and learned for the first time. Something that intrigued you. something that made you want to go to the Rubicon. And Ventura, California is a delightful place to visit if you don't happen to live nearby. It is. Anyway, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week. Same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten